Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and today we have got a topic that all of you are very much aware of, and it is the automobile industry, one of the bastions of the American economy for so many generations. Today we are seeing things happening within that industry that make a lot of people just shudder, and it's very sad because many things have been affected by the changes that have evolved through the years. Well, my guest today is one of two writers that has put together a phenomenal book. And if you like to know about the real stuff, this is a book you're going to want to get. It's called At the Crossroads, Middle America and the Battle to Save the Car Industry. My guest today is Mr. Amador, and we are talking to you from where, Abe?
I'm in Carmel, Indiana. It's a suburb of Indianapolis.
Well, I'll tell you what. When I started reading your book, I was so impressed with the way, first of all, the information that you and Ted Evanoff put together, the information you put together is so clearly stated. It is with a lot of thought, and it is presented in a way to not make a blame game, which I think is really to be commended, because it's so easy to go down that road. But you have presented facts and information that are absolutely amazing. But, of course, your background, you've authored a number of nonfiction books, one of them about Chuck Taylor, who is the man behind the Nike shoe, and some other materials. And then Ted Evanoff is a former automotive writer at the Detroit Free Press, and he's been very much involved in manufacturing, trade, and, of course, the automobile industry for over 20 years. So the two of you together, I think, made quite a team. What made the two of you decide that you wanted to take on this project? Because this is no small sack of potatoes that you opted to handle.
Yeah. I think you've read the book correctly. We don't have a dog in the hunt, if you know that expression.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not favoring the union, favoring business. As far as a blame game, there's plenty of blame to go around. So people made mistakes, and people were kind of narrow-minded and self-centered. We weren't trying to protect anybody or trying to single anybody out.
Right.
I am recently retired from the Indianapolis Star. I was looking for a book to do as writers are want to do. It's, you know, most topics that are worth writing about have been written about already. So finding an original idea, just as a writer, if you have any would-be writers out there listening, mm-hmm. they have to find a topic that hasn't been written about to death. Then they have to decide. They have to ask themselves the question, am I qualified to write this? Am I the right person to do this? What can I bring to the table that maybe somebody else couldn't? To answer that second question, which is related to your question, Ted and I are right here in central Indiana. Indiana is the number two auto manufacturing town in the state. In the early part of the 20th century, before Detroit was, you know, Motor City, Indianapolis was Motor City. That's why, for example, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, the oldest speedway, you know, big speedway in North America, was built in Indianapolis, not built anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Detroit eclipsed Indianapolis by the 1920s, but nevertheless, the state remained a major auto manufacturing town. So we knew about these plants. We knew where they were. We knew they were hurting. A major Chrysler transmission plant is in Kokomo, Indiana, just about 45 miles north of Indianapolis. In fact, I live between Kokomo and Indianapolis. We were well-placed to talk to people on the ground. Ted knew of people coming in from the Wall Street Journal, coming in from the BBC from London, coming in from Fox News, coming from everywhere to report on the crisis in the auto industry in towns in Ohio, and in Indiana, in Kentucky, in Illinois, in Michigan, of course, where you really have a lot of the auto industry. But these guys were all out-of-towners. You may be familiar with the term parachute journalism. They were doing parachute journalism, mm-hmm. coming in for a couple, 3 days and getting out. Every story read the same, and they were really superficial. So I had the idea, I had the time, being retired, I could go visit these people, I could meet these people. And Ted was the business writer, and Ted had covered the automobile industry. So we made a good team. I did a lot of the, just talking to ordinary people, talking to mayors, talking to economic development people. Ted knew a lot of the background of the auto industry, per se. And we knew each other for years at the newspaper anyhow, so we got along. We used to joke with each other. If people would only listen to us, all the problems of the world would go away. You know, we would do this over lunch. So we put our money where our mouth was, and we said, well, maybe we can sort out this auto crisis.
Well, I'll tell you what. I was very impressed with the very first part of it because it set the tone for the entire book of let's give the facts. Now, what I want to do is quote one of your paragraphs that you have because it is significant. Middle America has been scorched by the vicissitudes of a political and financial establishment in Washington and New York, unattached to a manufacturing base that is essential to the national security and the overall economic prosperity of America. Since 2000, 5 million manufacturing jobs have vanished in America, eliminating more than $200 billion in annual payroll. More than 23,000 factories have closed. The trade deficit has soared. Yes. So here you've got this situation.
Yeah.
It's just, these are things that really need to be quoted. And this is just about, you know, we're looking at an industry that was for many, many, many years the middle class America that was out there doing its job every day, and it helped us get through the Second World War, the Korean War. It enabled our prosperity. I mean, the automotive industry has a phenomenal history. And we've gone, instead of being self-sufficient, we now have become dependent on imports instead of being the one that's been putting out the exports like crazy. And yep. Our industrial base, as you have so succinctly put it, has been reduced to an afterthought. A cliche. And to me, that is gross ignorance and incompetence on the people that are in political positions, as well as many business people that haven't got a clue.
Well, we talk about companies that export jobs. That's what they're doing. They're exporting jobs. In their defense, what you can say is they're looking for the cheapest cost of production. They've got to compete with somebody else who's going to export the jobs. So it's a problem. As one fellow said to me, this is not in the book, he said, well, the jobs are going to go to Mexico, or they're going to go to Korea, or they're going to go to China, but they're not staying here. So, why? Because they're always going to, it's like water flowing downstream. Owners of companies will look for the lowest cost of labor. Now, for an individual company, that might be fine. But when every company does it, who are their customers anymore? Well, they may have customers abroad, but they're going to lose their customer base here in America. Mm-hmm. So who has to step in and say, factory XYZ or factory ABC, I don't want to mention any names, but any manufacturer might say, look, I've got to compete. I need lower cost labor. I need guys who show up for work on Monday and, don't dog it too much. I'm just going to go abroad. I'm tired of working with these local guys. A lot of individual factory owners may say that, may think that. They may be right. But the country, the nation, cannot let that happen. So you count on the leaders to say, to maybe to shape up the unions a little bit. There's a problem there. But to either remove the incentives to leave the country for the manufacturers or to create new incentives to stay here. I know one of the biggest disappointments, and this is going off on a tangent a bit, but in 2008, in the presidential election, Barack Obama said, let's have universal health care so that employers don't have to worry about this. We'll have just a different mechanism for funding it. I know when I was at the Indianapolis Star, I was the president of the union, so I'm not anti-union. I was the last, the immediate past president of the newspaper union there. So we were talking about contracts. This was two contracts ago, negotiating. And the publisher saying, you know, it costs you, you know, costs us a $15,000 to insure you, your wife, and your two kids. Did you know that? That's about what it costs. Now, you're picking up some of that, but that's the tab for a family of four. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know, realistically, you can go to China. You can get the whole employee for $15,000, not just the tab for the insurance bill on the character. So I thought, well, Obama, you know, he understood that much. You cannot have companies paying this huge insurance bill and then being competitive. Of course, I don't want to get into too much about, you know, what we got earlier this year, but it's not universal health care, and it doesn't protect the manufacturers, the employers, from paying this bill at all. So the national leaders are not doing what they have to do, to make it plausible to employ more people here in America. Now, another problem related to your question, not everybody's going to go to college. We talk about this in one of the chapters.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what people say is, we'll send everybody to college. Let the manufacturing jobs. There were people that none of the mayors I talked to, but in doing my research, there were mayors, including a past mayor of this city here in Indianapolis, but other mayors, saying, we don't want these smokestack jobs. We don't want these dirty industries. We're going, I mean, before it was cool to go green, they were saying, we're going green. We're going to be part of the information society. We're going high tech. We're going to be the next Silicon Valley. What nonsense. You're not going to have 100% employment in the professions, in engineering, in high-tech industry. The fact is, a lot of people, they're going to be factory workers all their lives. You know, they're going to put in their 35 or 40 hours, let them have a good life. They're good people, good citizens. They may not be Nobel Prize candidates, if you know what I'm saying. Those jobs are going away. So you have the real middle class now, doctors, lawyers, nurses, maybe school teachers. There are journalists to a certain extent, still have pretty good income in this country, still have a pretty good life, aren't facing foreign competition, and they're not too worried. They may say they're worried, but they're not too worried. You have illegal aliens, and there are illegal, I mean, there are illegal immigrants and aliens. They're not taking my job away at the newspaper. They're not taking some doctor's job away at the hospital, but they're taking a lot of trades jobs away. This idea that they're doing jobs that nobody wants, I'm not getting on an anti-immigration kick, but I've talked to Carpenters Union people here, to the building trades people, anybody who works outdoors, those jobs are being decimated. This is just as bad, and this may be my next book. This is as bad as what's happened to the car industry, except it really is an external threat doing it. Instead of the jobs being shipped abroad for cheap labor, what you have are the big contractors and the big developers are bringing in the workers and say, here, you go work for $6 an hour, and we don't have to pay some. We don't have to pay a union carpenter $24 an hour. I mean,
you know,
so these guys are going to be in the street. It's terrible.
Well, Abe, I have a little bit of a different paradigm, and I respect what you've said, and I agree with a substantial portion of it. But there's another thing that I have always felt has been one of the greatest strengths of the American mind. An American is anybody from any place in the world, and people from all kinds of cultures, all kinds of backgrounds. And the one thing we have always been known for is problem solving. And I really feel, and I sincerely mean this, that manufacturing can come back and can be done here in the United States. It's going to have to be done differently to be competitive. So it means taking thinking, and a lot of this can come from the blue-collar workers. What can we do so we can be competitive instead of fighting with it within their own groups, whether it's unions or whatever? We cannot continue to think like we did in the 40s and 50s. It's not going to work. We live in a much different environment. Manufacturing is necessary to any industry. China right now is going through some things that are really, really bad, yes, and automobile manufacturers in Europe are just doing a nice light tap dance right now because China is becoming one of the biggest consumers. So there are things that are happening there. We've had cycles like that here, but it takes a type of thinking outside of the box and the willingness to risk doing things differently, and I think, I firmly believe in that part of the American capacity, and I really think that that's going to come about. In your book, At the Crossroads, you talk about how Clyde Prestowitz Jr., who had been a trade advisor with the Reagan administration, said, you know, manufacturing can have a major resurgence in the United States, and I agree with that. But it has to be by those people and people at the ground level. And the reason I say that is that many years ago, I had a conversation with a guy who worked for Hughes Aircraft. And that company rewarded this man, and he was nondescript, but he had a capacity for problem solving, and he was right on the lines. And he and other people would say, I've got this idea. Now, at that time, the people in management were saying, weren't closing their doors. They were saying, bring your ideas to us. If you find a better way of doing something, let me know. Let's see how it works. If it works, great. If it saves us money, great. If it makes something safer, great. And this man would tell me about how he was getting all of these bonuses. And he loved it. He never, ever wanted to own his own company. He was the type, just like you said, someone that wanted to have a daily job, but loved to observe. And he would come up with concepts. Some of them worked, some of them didn't. When they did work, there was a bonus, a reward, and a sense of satisfaction. And he kept on with education. But he was never a guy that wanted to go to college, ever. And there are so many talented people out there. We need them. We need the carpenters. We need the plumbers. We need the electricians. These are not insignificant jobs. So manufacturing, I think, can really be significant. And your book is one of the best publications I've come across that shows the value of manufacturing and how it went through its golden era, if you will. And then you had the succeeding generations that just didn't get the picture. And then things now are in this crossover, and I think the challenge has, the gauntlet has to be thrown down. What are you going to do? How are you going to handle it? And no more bailouts. And you go into the bailout quite a bit, and I think this is, it's great information. It really gives us a lot of information that, you know, reporters weren't given. I get so tired of the yelling and screaming, don't you?
Well, I'll speak for myself on the bailout. I supported, in principle, having a bailout, whether it was done at the right time or done in the right way. The industry had to be saved. The bailout was not so much a GM or Chrysler bailout, though, as it was a bailout for the suppliers, for GM and Chrysler. In other words, Chrysler and GM owed money to people.
Mm-hmm.
So they were given money by the government to pay their debts. But GM and Chrysler didn't get to keep that money. Proof that I'm right is those two entities went bankrupt anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
There was a bit of a sleight of hand here that, and a bit of a misnomer to say that there was a GM or a Chrysler bailout. The suppliers were bailed out, and that was important. And then the UAW, without a doubt, was bailed out. Now, I have to give you an example that's happening right here in Indianapolis, Indiana, right now. One of the largest General Motors stamping plants, they do the sheet metal for bodies for cars,
mm-hmm.
here in Indianapolis, employs 650 people. GM announced they were going to close it a couple of years ago, actually before the crisis. They found a buyer a few months ago who wanted to buy that plant and wanted the workers to stay because the workers, you know, they're there already. They know how to run
right.
Run the tools and stuff. To make a long story short, the GM worker said no, no, no. Unbelievable. Why? Because a provision of the UAW contract was kept in force that if these guys lose their jobs locally, they get transferred to somewhere else as soon as there's a job opening with their seniority, and they get their expenses paid, and they get unemployment in the meantime while they're waiting to get these jobs. They have no incentive to stay. The new buyer wanted to have a reduced salary. So we're going to say
mm-hmm.
you left, we can't pay you UAW wages. GM was going to partly make up the difference, and there were other incentives being offered to say, look, let us sell this factory. You'll get paid by this new guy, and we'll give you some extra money, and it'll be a win-win-win situation. The worker said, no, this is a problem. This is So as far as people being ingenious and, you know, pulling together and being problem-solving, there's still a lot of unbelievable self-centeredness. And some people say, and I can't say they were wrong, some people say the GM in Chrysler should not have been bailed out. Let them go truly bankrupt. Somebody would have bought Jeep. The Jeep brand for Chrysler was not in doubt. Jeep sells okay. The minivan division would have been sold, and the Chrysler minivan would have still been around. Some of the front-wheel drive cars certainly would have been history because they're not popular anyhow. And some of the GM brands would have saved, would have been saved. Probably the ones that were saved anyhow, the GMC truck, Chevrolet, and Cadillac. Somebody would have bought those. Some of the plants would have stayed open. Who would have been hurt? Who would have been hurt? Only the unions, because the unions would have lost their contracts. So the, a Republican administration, without a doubt, would have done this bailout differently. It is disappointing to me that Obama was mostly interested in saving the unions here, and that was a payoff, not just to the UAW. And I say this as a former union president, but it pains me to say it, and his so much of his election base is with the public employee unions, who are really the largest unions now. But he had to really show his loyalty and fidelity. And he hurt manufacturing. He hurt manufacturing in the way that he did the bailout. And having said that, we still believe these industries had to be saved because we've lost so much manufacturing otherwise, as you know. Now, going forward, there's something called an international wage scale. I don't like the term. I didn't invent it, but I know what it means. Unless American workers can work at a price close to what workers in Mexico or China do, they're not going to get the jobs. It's like everybody's competing for the job. Everybody's applying for a job. And if you price yourself out of the market, then as an employee, that's what you've done. You've priced yourself out of the market. We cannot make manufacturers do business in America. We cannot stop foreigners from selling in America. There's all kinds of, you know, it's not just NAFTA, but it's the World Trade Organization, WTO, the World Trade Organization, and lots of treaties that we now have. They're almost a government unto themselves, say we have to allow free trade. All we can do is accuse other countries of cheating, which is certainly cheating. And it's in the book there that we know China is cheating right and left, but we let them get away with it, and then we're losing jobs to them. And that's a political issue. I don't know what to make of it. I don't know why we're afraid of China. You know, I mean, China is not going to send missiles our way. You know, we're not at war with them, nor will we be at war with them. But somehow we're afraid of China. I know they hold a lot of debt for us.
I think, again, it's a mentality. I think that if the American business is held to a certain standard, then every other business that their products come into this country, they should also be held to the standard. And
absolutely.
I do not think that in any way that is self-centered or selfish, because if we go to another country and we don't meet up to the standards that they have, we can't do business over there. And why we have evolved into this mentality, I think it is a mentality that is one of incompetence because of not really understanding business on the level of certain persons, and it's not just a individual, it's many individuals, because a lot of people that are in the positions of making decisions for the entire nation have never run a business. They don't have manufacturing. They haven't been there sweating it out with employees when equipment breaks down and you've got an order for 10,000 parts that has to be shipped out in a certain amount of time. Or maybe your whole computer system goes down because a lightning strike has just blown everything out of the system. They haven't lived it. They haven't sweated through it. They don't know what it's like. And until you are in the arena where your guts are out on the line, and that may sound a little gross, but unless you're in that arena and you know what it's like to sweat blood and tears, you cannot have an understanding at all. And there's this arrogance. There is this appalling arrogance and ignorance. And you look at every nation throughout history that has been successful, they have always had a good manufacturing industrial base of some type. You always have. It's just a fact of history.
We still have some manufacturing. It's you know, we make locomotives and we make airplanes and we make some super high tech stuff. Caterpillar's still around, so I don't want to ignore that. We have a lot of exports. We import more, but we still export quite a bit. We export almost nothing to China, though, which is interesting. We export almost nothing. I've written about this in the past. We export more raw materials to China, like trees, you know, and grain, than we actually export manufactured goods. So that's a problem. It's consumer goods and what are called consumer durables that are gone. There are no TV sets made in America anymore. There are no more small power tools made in America anymore. Washer dryers and refrigerators are on the way out, which is a disaster. A plant in Evansville, Indiana that made refrigerators right here in Evansville, it was closed down, and the owner is building a new plant in Mexico. Highly automated in Mexico,
mm-hmm.
So that labor is not a huge factor anymore. It's still somewhat of a factor, but you know there's OSHA regulations and there's you know all kinds of infrastructure issues. I mean, government regulations. You know, people who want to help the worker, they're strangling the worker. I know
yes,
that sounds like a conservative position. I know it sounds reactionary, but damn it, it's true. You know, sometimes the reactionaries may be right. Let's just take an honest look at what's going on here. So government policy, it's not just owners looking for bigger profits. That's part of it. But it's really bad Washington policy. And as you say, they know nothing about manufacturing. They don't know what they're doing, but they feel good about themselves that they're protecting workers. Now, there's a little anecdote in the book because I'm really not anti-worker. I want to be anti-management, at least in the same degree. I used to teach journalism at IU part-time, and I had a Japanese exchange student. I think this is in the book. Japanese exchange student wanted to interview the head of the Isuzu Subaru plant in Lafayette, Indiana, just when it opened in like 1990, 1991, something like that. Subaru was still there. Isuzu closed up shop. So she speaks Japanese. She went up there, talked to the head of the company there, got a nice interview. And what's relevant here is the guy said he had been warned about American workers. He had been warned they don't show up on Monday. You know, they take all their sick leave every year. They're bad workers or sabotage. He said it was exaggerated. He said that they don't show up on Monday on time. That is true. I remember that as a joke. They got some attendance problems, but overall they're not bad workers. But he said the white-collar workers, the managers, he said every resume he got, somebody with an MBA here, an MBA there, everyone was lies, lies, lies. I mean, this guy was being quoted by my Japanese exchange student with anger, with venom, that these people who said, we know how to do project management, we know how to run a line, we've supervised such and such, we have contact in industry. He would see these wonderful resumes from these white-collar workers, these middle manager types who wanted to work in Lafayette, and he would check them out. He'd say, okay, let's call around and see if it's true. Never did he get one that was true. He was disgusted. So there's a problem with American culture. There's a problem with people coming out of our business schools. There's a problem mm-hmm. with people who have worked in management, and I don't know what it is, but I got a hunch it's cultural. It's you know the old cartoon. You're old enough to remember Pogo. I've seen The Enemy,
mm-hmm.
and it's us.
That's right.
That's what I'm beginning to think.
Well, and I do think that the educational process, it has been promoted that when you get an MBA, you're going to make more than a couple of million more than the average person in your lifetime, and there are a lot of people that are being processed through the college system that have about maybe a blink of a concept. They have not had to work at anything. And I think that when they get out, they go, well, I've got this MBA degree. Well, that's fine. You know how to cross the T's maybe and dot the I's on a piece of a computer paper because you've got a spell checker, but that doesn't mean that you know how to get down on your back and assist somebody that maybe needs to have someone help them fix a machine. You don't know the automated system that well, and you haven't served an apprenticeship. And I think that is one factor that has really disappeared that needs to be looked at. It is honorable to work. And if you're going to be someone in a management position, you should know what it is for the person that's cleaning the toilets in the restroom, because that job is important, all the way up to the guy that has to supervise everyone else. You have to know what is going on. It's not just numbers in a book. It isn't
yep.
just the bottom line. It is everything working together. And I'll tell you, I think in American history, we have got some phenomenal results that we showed throughout the years. And I really do, Abe. I have a strong belief in the blue-collar worker and in the white-collar worker, but I think they need to respect each other and understand that there are we're all in this together. And when the jobs disappear, that means that we are not going to be able to stand on our own as a nation, as we need to be. And we need to get off of our high horses and get back down to terra firma.
Well, you're preaching to the converted on that, that's for sure.
Oh, I love it. Your book is absolutely incredible. You really are. I love the history that you have in it. I know we're just about out of time. You talk about France's electric tricycle of 1881 that actually ushered in the auto era. You go into the history of Ford. You go into about the new hybrids that are coming out. You've got so much wonderful information in this book at the Crossroads. And I know that you don't have a website relative to this, but your publisher, ecwpress.com, is really good. And for those of you listening, well, there's been little points of conversation that we've had here, but let's get past the politics. We need to understand that what's happening in the United States today, if we work with it, could be one of the best things that ever happened to us. And this book, At the Crossroads, gives you an inside track. So if you're one of those blue-collar workers or you're one of those white-collar workers and maybe you haven't liked some of the comments made, good. Get the book. Get educated. Don't just assume everything that you hear on the newscast, on television, is fact. These two men, Abe Amador and Ted Evanoff, they live in the area. They've talked to the people that live the experience. They've studied the history, and they give it straight. Right, clean, and simple. I encourage you to get the book, At the Crossroads. Abe, thank you so much for being my guest.
All right, thanks for inviting me.
It's been a pleasure having you. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Welcome, my lords and ladies, to the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Fair, located at Maris Farms in Buckley, Washington. For 3 weekends in August, starting August 7th and 8th, we will transport you back to the days of old, where magic and merriment reign. Come see the multitude of musicians, dancers, jugglers, gypsies, peasants, nobles, pirates, and prestidigitation. That's magic for you commoners. Learn to swing a sword or shoot a bow and be knighted by Her Majesty the Queen. Hold your breath as jousters wheel their mounts around to engage in full contact combat on the field of battle. Sign on to sail the seas with scurvy pirates, or sit down with friends and family for turkey legs and a fine brewed ale. Delights abound for the young and old at the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Fair, so come one and all, starting August 7th and 8th, for fun and excitement, and may your day be fair. For tickets and info, go to www.washingtonfair.com.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. I do have to tell you, I'm not able to take any phone calls. They are having some problems with the equipment in the studio, so the phone lines, for whatever reason, and they haven't been able to figure out why, have been disabled. So I'm not going to be able to take your calls today, but I did want to let you know that we're going to be talking tomorrow with Madeline Blair. Yes, we're going to be talking about feeling overloaded with stuff, electronic stuff. Boy, are you like me? Do you get a whole bunch of emails and you have to go through them and you have to eliminate the trash and then you have to figure out who you're going to respond to? All of that takes time, and by the time you look at the clock, you go, oh my goodness, where did those 3 hours go? Well, we're going to be addressing that. Riding the Current is the name of Madeline's publication, and we're going to be talking about that and some other things as well. So regrettably, I'm not going to give out the phone number to call into because you're not going to be able to do it. So what I'm going to be doing is sharing some information with you. First of all, don't forget, those of you in the state of Washington, this is the last weekend for the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Fair, and I'm so delighted to be a part of it. I really feel that this is just such a wonderful family event. And with all of the activities going on, and especially the masquerade that you're going to be having. Yeah, so people are encouraged to bring a mask, wear it, depict yourself in whatever character is your fancy for the day. And it is just going to be magical. Of course, there's all kinds of costumes, everything from the one I call Muddy Mary. Yes, 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 she's actually muddy. She actually douses herself with water and slathers mud all over herself because she's a beggar woman. And she really lives that image to the hilt. And then we have the knights in shining armor. And believe me, their armor does shine. We have the jousting. We have all kinds of tradespeople. We have blacksmiths. We have potters. We have seamstresses. We have all kinds of people doing things the way it used to be done. And, oh, just ever so much more, plus a lot of good food. So I hope that you'll come on out. And if you can, stop by my booth and say hello. I'm there doing many readings. I'll also have a whole slew of books if you're interested in any of them. Wonderful. And I have a booth that is decorated with bright yellow banners with large lions that are up on their hind legs, just really looking very regal. So look for me. I'm on the first street in the Renaissance Fair as you come down, and I'm right next to the gal that has masks that are designed all in feathers, absolutely incredibly gorgeous things. So do come on out. It's at the Maris Farms in Buckley, Washington. The hours are 10 until 6. This is the last Saturday and Sunday until next year. So I hope we'll see you there. Also, I want to let you know there are some broadcasts that are going to be coming up that I will be appearing on that you will be welcome to listen to and call into. That information will be forthcoming probably by the first of next week. Also, I'm going to be traveling to areas like Las Vegas, Nevada, also up to Anchorage, Alaska. That information is going to be in my newsletter, and I also will be giving it out to you through the show. So that just gives you a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And again, because I am not able to open up the phone lines today because we have some electronic problems, so we'll be able to do that tomorrow, I'm sure. Well, I wanted to share a bit of information with you about ball lightning. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen it or if you've ever had an experience with it. I have. And it's something you never forget. It's absolutely one of the most awesome happenings in your life when you're sitting in a room like me and my mother were one day in Miami, Florida, and an electrical storm had come up. And so we had been advised that you do not, when electrical storms come up, you don't do anything but just sit quietly until they pass. Usually it would last about 15 minutes. So we were sitting quietly in our kitchen area when a ball of lightning appeared in front of us and danced around in the air and then just disappeared. Well, this experience I saw more than once, and it's absolutely beautiful when you see it. Well, I'm not the only one that's had this experience, but there are some other people, and one that was documented on August 25th in 1965 was in Florida by a woman by the name of Clara. There was a ball of light that shot through her screened patio door, and she, her husband, and her neighbor just watched this ball of energy come into their home. It was orange-red in color. It was the size of a basketball, and it went all across the floor. Now, the one I saw was in midair. The one they saw was across the floor. Well, Clara had a fly swatter in her hand. Don't know if it was metal, I'm assuming, in 65, it wasn't plastic, and she swatted it. Well, the glowing sphere exploded after she swatted it, just like a pistol shot. And the friend said, well, that must have gotten him good. In 1953, during a dinner in Washington, D.C., three people were interrupted by a very, very intense noise, and a pencil-shaped streak of light slid into the room through the keyhole of the French door to the room. It formed into a 12-inch fireball. It flew over their heads and blew up when it hit the fireplace leaving a circular black blot on the bricks. It's a burn. You're dealing with a concentration of energy. Now, in 1958, there was a man, William Becker. He was in a deserted cabin in Minnesota. He and his five friends were seeking shelter, and they watched a ball of lightning enter through a tiny window frame hole. And they said it was white-yellow at the edges, orange in the middle, and it had all kinds of squiggly lines inside of its energy structure. It went across the rug and then disappeared through a wall. And when it did it, there was a noise, like a bang. 1960, Pennsylvania, a woman by the name of Louise Matthews was on her sofa relaxing when a ball of lightning visited. The closed window and blinds it entered through weren't affected at all. She actually saw it come through the material. And then the ball got close to her and actually touched her, and she heard sizzling. She touched her neck. She said the back of her hand ended up getting burned, and her hair fell out where it had been in contact with the fireball. The fireball then went out through a window. And one of the earlier records was in 1915 in Smithwick, England. This happens around the world. It was in a kitchen, and a blue-purple ball of lightning appeared above a stove. And there was a young woman in the kitchen, and she just decided she was going to smack it, and she did. It ended up burning her wrist because it was getting close to her waist, and so she just smacked it. She had a gold wedding ring on her finger, and her finger ended up being burned because the gold of the ring got so hot from the fireball. And the ball then disappeared, just like that. What they found was from the experience, there were holes left in her tights and her skirt, and all of the fabric in her clothes totally faded. This is good stuff. Fascinating information, don't you think? And it's all energy. It is something they really don't have an understanding of. They don't know why it will go into that ball formation, but it does. I have seen it. I've experienced it. It is for real. Donna Siebel here, and I know that some of you might be wanting to call in. We won't be able to do that because the telephone lines are not working properly. We're having some kind of an electrical challenge. So tomorrow, those lines will be open. And don't forget, we're going to be talking with Madeline tomorrow and talking about how to deal with all of the variables that so very much frustrate us in everyday life. I have a wonderful story to share with you about two very special dogs. Those of you who were listening to the broadcast yesterday heard me say that I was going to do that. Well, I will share it with you after we come back from break. This is Donna Siebel. We are going to be gone for just a moment. When we come back, I'll have the story about Val and Brandy. Great dogs. We'll be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Siebel. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says Glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says Glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. Phone lines are not working, but they will be working tomorrow. So just keep that in mind. And I apologize for that inconvenience, but sometimes things occur that we have no control over, and that is what is happening today. Okay, Val and Brandy, dogs. You all know I'm really a dog fan, and I had promised I would share this story with you today. This is about a wonderful, wonderful woman who found that her life was totally changed when Eileen and her husband, Jay, decided they were going to adopt a shelter dog. And what they found, and by the way, Eileen is a woman that makes pottery, she found this wonderful caramel-colored lab mixed with another breed, and she said, oh, this is just, this is just an absolutely wonderful dog. And she said she is so happy, and Brandy was just one of these joyful, enthusiastic dogs, and they just fell in love with her immediately. Now, the reason she was at the shelter is that her first owners had to let her go. They got divorced, and neither one of them wanted to take the dog. So Brandy was sent from one place to another place, and she often was kept in a very tiny cage for 10 hours a day. Now, this is a big dog. We're looking at a dog that's, anywhere 70 to 80 pounds. And Eileen was just amazed. Here was a dog that you would expect would be snapping at you, wouldn't be happy, but it was exactly the opposite. Well, Brandy, as soon as she was taken home by Eileen and her husband, Jay, she just was having the time of her life. She had a wonderful yard, and Eileen thought, you know, it's not fair just having the one dog. So she decided she wanted to adopt another one. So she went back to the rescue shelter, and she saw a puppy. And he was not in good shape. He was just so very, very thin. And one of the workers said that they had named him Val, short for Valenti. He had been found wandering the streets after Hurricane Katrina, and he was brought into this rescue shelter. Now, his breed, he was a yellow lab. He weighed only 40 pounds, which is half of his weight, obviously, that he should be. He also had staples across his chest. Eileen said that it reminded her of railroad tracks. There were that many in his chest. And this was a result of emergency intestinal surgery. He had also suffered a broken leg. He had heartworm and mange. This dog was sick. Now, the shelter had done a wonderful job of trying to take care of him, but Eileen said there's more than that that this dog needs. So she said, you know what? We're going to take him home. Well, the dog was so weak that he couldn't get into the car, but she said to herself, you know, we're going to really take care of this dog. And she managed to get him in. And Val, little by little, grew stronger, and he started cozying up also to Brandy, his buddy. And by golly, everybody fell in love with both of these adopted dogs. Now, what happened after this is that they had some friends that they had known in college, and one of their friends had a son named Zachary, and he absolutely loved these dogs. And he had been born with the Prader-Willi syndrome. Now, this is a chromosomal disorder that causes physical and developmental impairment. Zachary was only 6 years of age, but because he was so weak, he couldn't play the games the other kids played, and he had a hard time relating with other kids. But Brandy and Val didn't care. Whenever Zachary was around them, they would try to play with him. Now, this was something that wasn't an easy opportunity for Zachary, because Zachary lived with his family about 1,000 miles away from Jay and Eileen, so he wasn't able to get together very often. But Eileen started doing something. She started putting together a picture book. Now, Zachary, she knew, had a hard time turning the pages, so what she did, she created tabs at the bottom of the pages to make it easier. And then she made cartoons. And she made cartoons about the dogs, told stories about the adventures the dogs had, what they had been through, and how love had made them well. Well, Eileen, when she went to visit Zachary, she took along these books she had made, and as well as her buddies, and he just absolutely loved it. And when Zachary had to go to the hospital, he took Eileen's book with him. And he said, being part of Brandy and Val's world, it just means so much to me. So his mom made a suggestion to Eileen. She said, you ought to publish these stories. Well, Eileen thought, not a bad idea. So she started writing books. One was Brandy and Val, Real Dogs with Real Tails. Well, the kids loved the books. And there was a kindergarten teacher whose two students had trouble sharing about life until they started seeing the cartoons that Eileen had made in her book. A little girl that had autism, rarely if ever spoke, but loved the dog book, really related to the drawings as well. Well, this was getting around, and Eileen started getting feedback. She was amazed. She didn't believe that one book could make such a difference. She wrote two more books, Brandy and Val's Favorite Things and Brandy and Val's Special Story. And all of the proceeds of these books go to Animal Rescues and the Prader-Willi Foundation in honor of her family friend, Zachary. Now, the dogs, they have become certified pet therapy dogs, and Eileen takes them out to any environment where children can meet, talk with them, and also be made aware of her book. She said, we're so glad that we gave these dogs a second chance. Brandy and Val took the love we gave them, and today are giving it back to these kids in a message of hope hundreds of times over. One person can make a difference. One dog can make a difference. One anything can make a difference. It's one plus one plus one. It adds up on all levels of life. And if I could just leave you with a thought today, not only to remember that you're the master of your fate, that you're the captain of your soul, but also to remember that you yourself have been given abilities and talents that are meant to be used to their fullest capacity. And life really is that adventure to help you to discover them so that you can share them with others. Whether it's writing a children's book, maybe knowing how to fix plumbing, doesn't make any difference. You're needed. You're wanted. We just need to know about you, that's all. So don't be afraid to step up to the plate of opportunity and join into this experience we call life with enthusiasm, optimism, and a love of working. It will serve you well. This is Donna Sebo. We'll see you here, right here at BBS Radio tomorrow, same time, same place. And by the way, don't forget, if you've missed a show, you can always check the archives on the Donna Sebo Show. It's always there waiting for you for your convenience. This is Donna. We'll be talking with you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to the Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.